This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Michael Levy, who is the Fellow for Science and Technology and Director of the Program on Energy, Security, and Climate Change at the Council of Foreign Relations. His new book is Nuclear Terrorism. Michael, welcome to Berkeley. Where were you born and raised?
I was born and raised in Vancouver. I lived there until I went away to college in Eastern Canada and then moved to the States after that. And I've been here since, save about a year and a half in London.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
My parents shaped my thinking about the world, I think, first, just by where I was born. We tended to have more of a focus when it came to the rest of the world in Asia than where I live now on the East Coast, where we automatically look to Europe. The other big piece of how my parents shaped how I saw the world is my father was born in Calcutta and left when he was 18, and my grandparents and their parents were born in Calcutta. So you have a bit of a different view of the world automatically.
So it's a cosmopolitan heritage, really.
It is. My mother's family is from Vancouver, from Winnipeg in Ukraine, ultimately, like so many other Canadian immigrants. And my father's from that part of the world, and before that, let's say about 150 years ago, Iraq.
And where were you? You said where you were educated, but what studies did you pursue as an undergraduate?
So as an undergraduate, I was at Queen's University in Kingston. I studied mathematical physics. I threw in a couple other things, a philosophy course, a computer science course, but in Canada, you really are asked when you're 17 or 18 to choose what it is that you are going to do. So mathematical physics, which was mostly math and a little bit of physics. Then I went down to Princeton to work on a PhD. I was studying string theory. And I did all my exams and I spent some time doing research and decided it wasn't really for me and ended up floating into the policy world.
And what was the turning point in making that decision to go from science to public policy, but using science in your analysis of public policy?
Well, it wasn't really a deliberate decision. I decided that I wanted to explore different things, but I wanted to be able to use what I'd spent so much time on, and there weren't all that many different options. There was science journalism, there was science policy, there were things like patent law, but it was a fairly narrow set. And I sat in on a course on science and policy. I still wasn't sure that was what I was interested in. I decided to take a year off of grad school. I was going to travel the world, and someone offered me a job in Washington at the Federation of American Scientists, which had been founded during the Manhattan Project by Manhattan Project scientists to shape policy on nuclear weapons. It seemed like an interesting opportunity. I took it. That was summer of 2001. The 9/11 attacks were a couple months later, and all of a sudden, a lot of what we were doing became very salient, and it was an exciting time to stick with it.
I'm curious, what are the skills required for this interface between the world of science and the world of public policy?
Well, there's an obvious intersection when you're looking at things like nuclear policy or energy policy, and there's a lot of technical content in them. So being able to understand some of the technology, some of the science, is useful. Now, you also have to have a decent understanding of the politics and the policy. And there's a habit of scientists to say, those guys, they don't understand the science, they don't understand the technology, and not to realize that as scientists, they may not understand the other side. But I've always thought that there was another dimension that came from physics more than math that was probably more important. A theoretical physicist learns to throw out 90% of the problem and come up with 90% of the answer. And when you're dealing with something very complicated in a political situation, in international relations, it's important to be able to simplify without oversimplifying and to know what you're getting at and also to know what you're missing.
Mm-hmm. So is it, when you look at these two worlds, do you think it's harder for the scientists to understand the politicians and the policy analysis, or the policy analyst and the politician to understand the scientists?
I don't know that one is easier than the others. Certainly the science world I came from thought that it was easier for them to get the policy than the other way around. And there have been more people who've migrated to the intersection of science and policy from the science side than from the policy side. But there is a tendency in the scientific world to want things to be neat and simple and follow rules. And that doesn't work so well in the political world. It works well in the legal world. A mathematician can become a very good constitutional lawyer, but not necessarily a great political analyst. There have been people who've moved effectively the other way. The example I always think of is Joe Nye, who is through and through an international relations person, understands the nitty-gritty of uranium production, what we call the uranium fuel cycle, better than almost any physicist involved in policy that I know. But it's a rarity.
Mm-hmm. You said you worked at the Federation of American Scientists before 9/11, and then obviously you've gone to the Council since 9/11. You're sitting there on the cutting edge of the politicization of what you're studying, not because of where you were in the two roles, but rather because of how international politics seemed to be changed by that event, namely the attack of 9/11. Talk a little about that. I mean, other than the fact that you probably became a hot commodity because of the knowledge you had.
Well, I was at the Federation of American Scientists until spring of 2003. So a lot of the evolution happened then, not just through 9/11, but through the Iraq War, also before I went to the Brookings Institution, and then eventually to the Council. When I went to the Federation of American Scientists in the summer of 2001, issue number one when it came to nuclear policy was national missile defense. It was all about missile defense, and that's what we were focused on. And to the extent that you talked about nuclear terrorism, it was in the context of missile defense, in making the argument, why are you focused on missile defense when someone could bring something in by a ship, by a truck, when the real threat is nuclear terrorism? But it really was only talked about in that context, except by some people who really had a sharper focus on it. After the September 11th attacks, we started to focus a bit more on other things. And a couple months later, I was asked to take over the program. And the same time, whenever you're asked to take over a program, you're also just about to run out of money. This is how these things work. And that was in some way an opportunity, because instead of being stuck with the grants that you'd sorted out before 9/11 that were all about missile defense, you could write what your new program was going to be. And it was a time to really look at things. The organization had been focused very much on advocacy, and I pushed hard in that situation to say, we need to do a little bit more in the way of analysis right now. We're looking at a different world. The world may not have changed on 9/11, but we perhaps realized that it had changed a lot on 9/11, and we needed to rethink some basics. And so we did shift in a direction where we did some more careful thinking. We did a lot of work that I'm proud of on radiological weapons, on dirty bombs that had some influence on the debate, I think a calming influence on some of the debate, and then moved on from there. And the program since then has still focused a lot on these issues.
Mm-hmm. You write in the beginning of the book, we must learn how to think about nuclear terrorism. And I think that your book is actually very interesting. It's very analytical, and it really is leading us down the path of breaking the problem down into its parts so that we can see the whole.
That's what I try to do in the book. We have one way of thinking about nuclear terrorism, and it involves a lot of imagination. And there's a reason for that. We've never seen a well-developed nuclear terrorist plot, so it's a very easy thing to do, to imagine all sorts of variations and all sorts of worst-case scenarios. And what I want to do and what I try to do is bring it a bit back down to earth. Yes, it's unfamiliar, so we shouldn't rely entirely on past experience, but there is a lot we can learn from past experience in counterterrorism and in other areas. And there's also a lot we can learn about how our responses might or might not be effective.
It's almost, if one were looking for an analogy with medicine, what comes to mind is, you know, cancer, basically. Nobody wants to kind of think about the problem, you know, different kinds of cancers and so on. And in a way, it struck me that what you're trying to do is say, well, we can't look at nuclear terrorism, you know, with this sort of fear, this great fear, but really it's really, well, what are the aspects of the problem that we really have to consider? And that's a real challenge for you as a writer, but also to make your readers sit down and go through this piece by piece.
It's difficult because it's a bit uncomfortable for people. With something this scary, we want silver bullet solutions. We want simple solutions. And usually simple solutions mean that we don't need to get really into the guts of a nuclear terrorist plot and into tricky trade-offs and fairly scary things. So I do want to take people through it. And some of it is analytical and some of it can be challenging to understand, but a lot of it we can understand by relating to things that are more familiar with us. And so I try to draw the reader through with a lot of analogies to things that are more familiar. That's the way to understand things that you haven't experienced. That comes from my time doing things in string theory and general relativity. When you work in 11 dimensions, you have to work through analogies because you can't really get your hands on things. You haven't directly grappled with them. And you need to relate them, however imperfectly, to things that you have experience with.
There's an anecdote in the literature on the response to 9/11 by Susskind, in which I think it's called the 1% solution. That and it is alleged that Vice President Cheney said, if there's a 1% chance, we have to assume that if there's a 1% chance, we have to respond in that way. And really, the thrust of what you're saying is, no, not really, in the sense that we have to look at all sorts of things that may make it impossible for this awful thing to happen.
I want to look at things that make it improbable
Yeah.
for these things to happen. I think a quest for perfection is an enemy of a good, smart defense. Part of what the vice president said in this 1% doctrine does make sense. Small probabilities of extreme events are things we naturally and to some extent sensibly focus on. And in my work, for example, on climate change, I end up looking through a similar lens. But we have to be careful not to focus just on those worst case things because we miss opportunities. If we inflate threats too much, we look at our defensive options and we will continuously say, this option is useless, that option is useless, the other doesn't work, because we're facing such a forbidding enemy. If we bring it down to earth, we actually start to find more things that we can do to make that threat even less likely.
And what this means in you know, when we get to the nitty-gritty is that you're one of your arguments is you cannot separate the effort at countering nuclear terrorism from the counter-terrorism effort.
There's a habit of putting nuclear in a separate category. Part of it comes from the fact that people who study nuclear terrorism generally, but not always, come from technical backgrounds. They tend to look for technical solutions. But a lot of the pieces of bread and butter counterterrorism and homeland security apply quite well to nuclear terrorism as well. And I like to think about border security here. We have enormous efforts devoted at radiation detection. But if someone is smuggling nuclear material across the border, I suspect we're more likely to detect them because we see them acting nervous, because we see them uncomfortable. And you look at the Millennium bombing plot, where Ahmed Rassam was stopped coming into the United States, not because someone detected the explosives in the trunk of his car that he was going to use in the bombing plot, but because one of the border officers saw him acting, they said, hinky. Mm-hmm. Not quite sure what that means, but it means something like nervous.
Yeah.
And then they looked in the car and they searched and they found the explosives. So they had certain capabilities to find the explosives, but there was that human element that was there. And there are a lot of these things that happen. If you look at a nuclear plot, again, if a plot gets too big, someone might spill the beans and go to authorities. That's a non-nuclear tool. And to the extent we can identify these, we can take steps that don't only deal with nuclear terrorism, but that have payoffs in other areas too.
And the ultimate implications of what you're saying, it seems to me, is that this should help our political leaders decide where to put the money, because it may be more important to be training border personnel to be aware of certain things, not just the human dimension, but also things that they should be watching for, you know, as opposed to elaborate things that one could think of doing to if one had this big fear of nuclear terrorism.
Right. Look, the number one thing that you can and should do to lower the odds of nuclear terrorism is to get as tight security as possible on nuclear materials at the source. Mm-hmm. They don't occur in nature, they can't be made by terrorist groups, and they're at a limited number of places. You want to get security on those and prevent them from spreading as much as possible. But you're not going to achieve perfection. That comes to what you're talking about. How do you do the rest of the defense? And it's not going to be some kind of careful calculation mm-hmm. and optimization problem where I draw a big diagram with all the options and sort out what mm-hmm. the best thing is. It's going to be a political conversation. There are going to be trade-offs. I can talk about ways to empower police on the street to detect plots. I might talk about giving them the capability to spot something while they're walking along to know what they might be looking for. I might talk about giving them search powers that are greater. And when you decide which of these sorts of things to pursue, that's a much bigger conversation than just nuclear terrorism. There are big trade-offs in society and civil liberties and things like that. What's important, though, is that those conversations, those decisions be informed and grounded in very solid analysis and understanding of the problem.
You talk about, and I think this is important, that you can take a thing like protecting the nuclear materials and just really very simply lay out what you need to think about. Talk about that a little, because it's a problem of defense, but it's also a problem of auditing and so on.
There are different pieces when it comes to keeping control over nuclear materials. We've gotten into an unfortunate habit where we talk about locking down nuclear materials. It sounds great because it sounds like you can take all the nuclear materials in the world, put a big padlock on the door, and not worry about things anymore. And people use an analogy to Fort Knox. Gold doesn't get out of Fort Knox, so why should nuclear material have any chance of getting out of a facility? The problem is that a lot of nuclear materials are used day to day in science and in defense applications. And so what you're doing is you're not really putting locks on the doors. You are creating procedures, for example, that make it less likely that someone could walk off with the materials. That's very different from Fort Knox. Fort Knox, there's been no significant amount of material removed in decades because you're not allowed to. And if someone walked out with it, you would know that something bad was going on. If someone walked away with something from a nuclear facility, it wouldn't be so definite. On top of it, even if you can have technical procedural solutions, not everyone necessarily wants to cooperate. We see in Pakistan right now huge challenges in trying to sort out cooperation, even if all sides want to improve security. And people worry that in some countries like North Korea and perhaps Iran in the future, there might not be a desire for complete security. There may be a desire for cooperation.
Mm-hmm. So in a way that is it, if we look at this recent incident where I think some nuclear weapons I can't remember exactly what was it. It was missiles that flew from one base to another.
Yes.
And the shocking thing, I don't think the weapons were armed. The nuclear devices were not armed. But the shocking thing was that the auditing process broke down. In other words,
correct,
there was a movement. So this is exactly the kind of problem that we have to deal with. And had before 9/11 we become lazy, and there's still some indications that laziness continues, even though we're in the post 9/11 world?
Well, I think the idea of saying that this is laziness has an implication that if we just wake up, we'll solve all of it. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, when you have complicated systems with human elements, things go wrong once in a while. Mm-hmm. And this case with the bombs that got flown on an aircraft and essentially disappeared for quite some time without mm-hmm. anyone realizing that they were gone is a case perhaps where in retrospect you could have figured out another step to make it less likely, but there were a lot of controls in place. Ultimately, when you repeat things over and over and you have human elements, things can slip up. And trying to put all your eggs in one basket, in the case of nuclear terrorism, putting it all in the basket of locking it down at the source, even if it's the most powerful piece, is dangerous because things go wrong.
Mm-hmm. Now, a fascinating part of your book is an explanation of how a nuclear device works and how a dirty bomb would work. And what I found interesting, it was a very clear discussion. For a non-scientist, I appreciated that very much. But you're using this to help us understand the pieces that have to come together to make the weapon.
Right. I talk about the variations on approaches that might happen because, again, I'm trying to move away from this one example that we have to focus on, this one worst-case threat, because there are easier and harder ways and circumstances in which a group would make a nuclear weapon, and that leads to different things that you would do for defense. Now, I describe things at a fairly theoretical level, and that's important because you don't want to be giving away the keys. You don't want to be telling people how to do things. I myself think that actually putting things from theory into action is much harder than describing them. So understanding those pieces is important to helping us figure out defense. So I'll give one example here. I talk about the fact that a group would probably need to take uranium that it got stolen, black market, supplied by a state, and turn it into the shapes that they might need for a nuclear weapon. And I look at little things that could go wrong. I look at what could happen if they tried to cast it into a certain shape and things didn't work quite right. I look at how they could start fires if they didn't machine things properly. Small chances of failure that can add up.
Mm-hmm. And also possibility of an accident that in the construction of either one of these devices.
Absolutely. We tend to look for the ways that groups could succeed. It's as important to look for the ways that they could fail, and accident is one part of that. It's luck. Mm-hmm. We tend to push luck aside a little bit too much. Luck plays a very important role in whether a plot succeeds. When they have to roll the dice that many times, it does become a big factor.
Is fear a problem in this? Fear in the sense that our political leaders are so worried about the possibility that they don't bring that analytical distancing that breaks the process into its parts?
We've never been comfortable with that analytic distancing when it comes to nuclear issues. After World War II, when people started to think about nuclear strategy, they essentially threw everything they'd known about strategy from before the nuclear era out the window. And it started to come in some basic ways throughout the Cold War, in careful ways. But people were uncomfortable. And we do have the same situation today. In particular, the fear drives us towards this search for perfection. Mm-hmm. And even if we're willing to admit that we won't have perfection, we still need to strive for it. And if we strive for it, the idea is that whatever we come out with, even if it's not perfect, is the best thing we can get. And it doesn't actually work that way. Sometimes setting somewhat lower and more practical goals ends up giving you a more effective defense. But no one, as a political leader, wants to say, here are our realistic goals. We are not going to aim for absolute perfection. It's not a political winner.
Mm-hmm. Now, would you say that the effort to make sure that the potential for loose nukes in the former Soviet Union, beginning with the end of the Cold War, has been a successful effort in moving down the road that you're talking about?
It's been a successful effort that could be a lot more successful with more invested. And when I say more invested, I mean in particular political energy. Mm-hmm. We fight mostly over dollars. How much money is being spent on this? How much money is being spent on that? Right now, you need to be looking at the political barriers that need to be overcome. If you want access to particular sites where security systems might be installed, the things like that require high-level intervention. They can't just be done by spending more money. There is a lot more to be done, though. If you look at the percentages of places that have been secured with assistance and those that haven't, a lot have been. There's a lot missing. The numbers change every day.
But in a case like the former Soviet Union, you have the breakdown of a system, of a political system, and then a relationship with a former adversary, us, the U.S., that has changed, but we really have the knowledge to help them move down the right road here. So you get an entanglement of all sorts of different goals that could be problematic, basically.
And it was very difficult because of some of that to move forward, in particular before 9/11. A lot of Americans saw this as a boondoggle where the United States would be essentially financing the Russian military. A lot of Russians still today see it as insulting. Why do we need you to help fix our problems? And to some degree, it is insulting. We tend to equate the fact that the United States hasn't helped secure a facility with the fact or the conclusion that that facility isn't secure. It is possible to secure something without American assistance that's been done. But it would be nice to have a better window in there. After 9/11, some of the worry about subsidizing the Russian military changed a bit. I think we got a more serious sense of priorities. There was a big fight before 9/11 trying to cut the funding significantly for these assistance programs to Russia.
That is a fight in the United States.
In the United States, in the U.S. Congress, and with the administration to substantially cut the efforts. It changed after 9/11, and the administration did take some serious initiatives to step things up, in particular to make this not just an American effort, to bring in the G8 as partners. They call 10 plus 10 over 10, where the U.S. would invest $10 billion over 10 years and be matched by the partners by $10 billion. And then all sorts of other states have stepped in to work on that. Now, it's not clear the money is all going to the right place, but there has been progress. It still could be done faster and with more emphasis if it was made higher priority.
Mm-hmm. Another section in your book is instructing us to really know our adversary. Who are the terrorists? What are their risk calculations? Talk a little about that, because it would seem to be very important in addressing the problem.
We tend to not think about that. Folks in the nuclear world sort of assume they understand how terrorist groups work, and folks in the terrorism studies world assume they understand the nuclear basics. And it's not always true that each understands the other. A lot of the most apocalyptic terrorist groups are actually quite afraid of failure. It's not clear that all of them are, and that's why each defense I talk about in the book doesn't necessarily apply to all terrorist groups. But people who've studied their habits tend to conclude that they are fairly averse to failure. Brian Jenkins, one of the deans of terrorism studies in the United States, has gone so far as to say that to fail for a very religious terrorist is tantamount to a judgment by God. That's a lot of weight on your shoulders when you're trying to pursue a plot. The other big piece of evidence for failure aversion, and something that really has a direct impact on how you can think about defense, is it drives groups to be conservative in their operations. They will innovate if they have to, and you saw innovation in the 9/11 plots. But they'll also try to stick to their bread and butter tactics as much as they can, because mixing them things up introduces a new risk of failure to them just in that process of innovation. So in the 9/11 attacks, you saw innovation. You also saw pretty standard approaches to moving operatives, to moving money, to some elements of training. So you do see these characteristics, and they can lead you to different ways of thinking about defense.
And what struck me in reading your book is that the notion of a war on terrorism, which is the way we've defined the problem, makes the adversary what is typically seen as an instrument, namely terror as an instrument of somebody that has political goals. And in your book, you're saying it's important to understand their political goals if we're going to get a sense of who might do what.
In some cases, the political goals are critical. And in most cases, the political goals of a terrorist group aren't going to be consistent with pursuing nuclear terrorism. Most of these groups need to maintain large constituencies that aren't particularly interested in mass destruction and mass murder. So they're kind of out when it comes to nuclear terrorism. You have sort of the lone dangerous person who may be crazy and may want to just kill, but they may not and probably do not have the capability to pull anything off. What you find dangerous is where there's an intersection of capability with the pursuit almost in itself for mass destruction. When the political goals start to slide away, that's when things get dangerous. But religious goals also impose certain constraints.
Mm-hmm. So you know, I think the terror out there that we have is of the religious fanatic who's gotten a PhD at Berkeley. I mean that's kind of this the big fear. Talk a little about that. I mean, how do should we worry more about religious fanatics?
We're worrying quite a bit about religious fanatics already, so I don't know that we need to be worrying more about religious fanatics. Maybe we should be worrying more intelligently about religious fanatics. The image, by the way, you bring up, and I find it interesting, of the religious fanatic with the PhD from Berkeley, and there is that scenario people talk about. There's always this thing that gets brought up about the Pakistani physics lounge where the professors sit around together and they're furious at America and they decide we're going to make a nuclear bomb. That's sort of similar. Yeah. And the questions I always ask when people bring that up, I say, okay, who are these mafia folks or tough guys they know who are going to get a hold of the nuclear material? Who are their technician friends who are going to build things? Who are their operational contacts who know how to keep it secret? Who are the folks they know in the shipping industry that they're going to get to have things smuggled in? It's not just one smart guy who can do physics. The physics may very well be the easiest part of the entire thing.
So there's an interesting problem here as I read your book, and that is politicians running for office who perceive threats and who don't want to be outmaneuvered by their political opponents at home. Want to find ways to get a handle on something.
Yes.
And so, for example, at Berkeley, I know we've had problems with getting the visas for postdocs. So there's been a real impact on the planning process for bringing young PhDs here to do postdoctorate work in a number of fields for which a potential national security threat was perceived. Talked a little about that. I guess the problem is you're instructing us to break it into pieces, look at the problem as it actually is. But right. In fact, the political response tends to be, well, let's do something about visas so these Pakistanis won't come here to study.
I had a friend in graduate school, this before 9/11, an Indian friend, and he got asked point blank in his visa interview, will you use what you learn in graduate school to build nuclear bombs? His response was something to the effect of string theory isn't all that useful to do much of anything. I don't know how convincing that was, but they did let him in eventually to the United States. And I've had to deal with visa processes like that also. That's one interesting element. I'm not entirely sure that the approach I take tells you what way to go one way or another on that, because the decisions that you want to make there are in a broader framework. You're looking at the image of America in the world that you get through this visa process. You look at the connections that you're making by bringing people in from the rest of the world. You're looking at the contributions to overall technological competitiveness. What the book identifies is how this all plays in to the nuclear area. How useful is it to clamp down on particular types of people or track particular types of people? What roles could they play? What roles couldn't they play? And if you have that information, you can feed it into a much more intelligent discussion about things like visa problems. But I don't want to pretend that some approach strictly based on nuclear terrorism should tell you exactly what you should do about all these big policy issues that have a lot of other implications.
One of the sections deal with the problems of rogue regimes such as North Korea, collapsing states and how you respond. Is that a particularly difficult problem that moves this whole discussion to another level?
It's a different problem. It's a different problem, well, several different problems. Collapsing states can be in two categories. One of the things I talk about is the value of law enforcement, intelligence, and observation in trying to stop a nuclear plot. Now, of course, if the state ceases to exist, it's not quite clear who's going to be doing the stopping and the observing. So that's one problem. Then you get into the possibility that a state that is nuclear armed collapses and doesn't have the same kind of control over its nuclear assets. And we talk about this a lot in Pakistan these days. And people speculate with North Korea that North Korea is quite a stable country right now, unless we move very strongly to destabilize it. But things do get trickier. You don't have the same sort of leverage. The kinds of custodial controls over nuclear weapons and materials can break down. And frankly, there is no particularly good answer in those cases. That makes it even more important to move away from the search for perfection and simply say, what can we do to make things less likely to go bad? Some of them are things we need to prepare for to do afterwards, stabilize states, hunt down materials and weapons. Some are things we could do now cooperatively in establishing security in enduring ways for weapons and materials. But it's tricky. It's a mix, and none of it is going to be fantastic. Just knowing that helps inform your decisions on how much you should invest in trying to keep these states solvent.
And you're suggesting that one of the problems with a collapsing state, if you're too aggressive in dealing with the problem, is that you can further the collapse of that regime that may have been better than what follows.
Right, and again, it's complicated. You look at North Korea, for example. It's a terrible regime. It treats its people terribly. It's a danger in the region. And it might make sense intuitively to try to bring about its collapse. But there are obvious downsides, including the potential that its nuclear assets would become more vulnerable to other groups, including to terrorist groups. And how do you strike the balance? Again, depends how much you value the different pieces. But it needs to be informed by some understanding of what you can do. And with North Korea, you could probably do a decent amount to stabilize things. You could probably do a decent amount to stop smuggling out through sea. The bigger worries probably are if you started to move North Korea toward collapse, they could quite easily fire off a nuclear weapon or two of their own. And that's obviously a horrific situation.
There's a lot of worry now about Pakistan and what would be the case if there was a collapse there, the state unraveled, and the security of the nuclear weapons was in doubt, requiring perhaps us to go in and do stabilization, basically. That is, at a minimum, to protect the secure the weapons.
It would be difficult to do that because it's not clear that we would know where the weapons were. There are fixed facilities that we could deal with, but locating weapons would be very hard. Now, remember, the goal is not to keep the weapons under our control. It's to keep the weapons out of bad guys' control. Those are two different problems. When you look at the second, you can start to do other things involved in stability, involved in keeping people away from certain areas that might be particularly vulnerable. But we also have to look at the sort of cooperation we're willing to do now to make that kind of outcome less likely. And I don't think we're thinking big enough about that. There's been a recent debate on Earth. The debate has been going on for several years, but was recently written about, over whether to provide Pakistan with what we call permissive action links, PALs, something we integrate into the essence of a nuclear weapon that requires you to enter a code to make it work, and it disables the weapon if you fail. And what we've had is we've had this really maddening debate go on within the administration. Technologists sort of set aside the legal restrictions that say you can't cooperate with a state like Pakistan and dream up ideas to help them. And then the lawyers completely ignore the terrorism issue and say, you're not allowed to do this. And they're both missing the point. We do need to think bigger about what the new rules of the game are instead of trying to navigate this narrow path that was written for us a long time ago. We need to acknowledge that there are states that have nuclear weapons, even though we would rather they not. And we may need to cooperate to keep them more secure. But we need to figure out a context to do that in where we don't simply promote a greater spread of nuclear weapons to more countries and continually cause more problems that we then need to solve.
I'm struck by how, as a scientist, you rationally inform us about what the issues are. But then when we move into policy, we really run up against issues of power, conflict of interest, national interest, and all sorts of these human elements and political elements that are a part of the process of taking this knowledge and solving the problem.
That's right. One of the things I focus on hard in this book is putting defense together as a system. Mm-hmm. So making sure the different pieces work together. Anyone who has dealt with government knows that making pieces work together is not one of the fortes of the U.S. government or of other governments. There have been attempts to coordinate nuclear security, counterterrorism, across the U.S. government, and they failed. They stepped on too many bureaucratic toes, and each organization we see that's been established has some big, important piece cut out of it, or if it has a wide view, it's got no power to actually do anything. And I don't suspect that hitting our heads against the wall over and over and over is going to solve this. Frankly, you're drawing on things from across the government that have many different missions, and you're not going to put them all under one roof. We don't need to rehash the Department of Homeland Security debate. It's far from clear that that's done anything to improve the situation. But you need to accept that you can't do that and look for what I call softer approaches, ways you can promote coordination and cooperation from the ground up that may not get you a perfect outcome, but they do acknowledge that there are these tensions within organizations, within governments, that you need to manage and navigate.
I have your list of recommendations here. Let's see if there are things that we need to bring out here. You want to improve controls over nuclear weapons and materials.
We've talked a lot about that, and that's the number one piece that I have in there because it still is the most important thing to do. In my book, I discover a second reason for why it's important. The one we all focus on is if we can keep these out of terrorist hands, we're going to be better off. We don't need to test the rest of the defense. What I look at also is how a strong effort to secure weapons and materials sets things up for the rest of the defense. There are a variety of different kinds of weapons and materials and circumstances in which a terrorist group could get their hands on them. And the tighter the control, the more opportunistic a group is going to need to be. And as a result, they're more likely to have the kinds of weapons or materials and be in the sorts of situations where the rest of the defense can be more effective. They may be more vulnerable later on to border security or law enforcement. So I see those two reasons really strengthening the case. And it's different from how people have looked at this before. Traditionally, people say, oh, you want to deal with the other parts of the defense, you're taking away the attention from materials and weapons security. I'm saying that each of the two make the other stronger.
Mm-hmm. Second, address nuclear terrorism at the same time that we're addressing other terrorist threats. This is terribly important.
It's very important. We do a narrow sort of analysis that separates nuclear off. And it's a problem for a couple of reasons. And the first is that often non-nuclear tools are much more powerful than nuclear tools. So it's often much easier to spot the terrorist than to spot the nuclear material that the terrorist is carrying. It's much easier, perhaps, to spot a safe house than it is to know exactly what's going on inside it when it comes to machining, for example, nuclear materials. So we need to look and appreciate these non-nuclear tools. It's also important because it has a big effect on how we design and plan defense. Once we see that we're looking at a lot of non-nuclear tools, we have to look much more broadly at how counterterrorism and homeland security works within our government and within other governments and how we work with them to solve these problems.
You make a strong case of looking at the full range of possibilities and not just the worst-case scenario.
Right, and I like to think of this through an analogy to a police department. Imagine you've got a police department that's worried about bank robberies, and it decides that it's going to focus on the worst case, bank robbers that have cars that can go 300 miles an hour. And they do their analysis, and they say, why are we bothering to buy our cars carefully? Let's not worry about chase tactics. Let's not sort this out. Let's just make sure the banks are secure. And then one day, the bank security doesn't quite work. The robbers get their money, and they get into their car, and that car goes 100 miles an hour. And they take off, and the police department's not prepared. It hasn't planned for the car chase. It hasn't thought carefully through what equipment it needs. And what you've got is a situation where overestimating the threat led you to do less, and you weren't prepared and capable to deal with the lesser threat. So there's a bit of a paradox there. Ratcheting down the threat assessment or making it more varied can actually lead you to do more rather than less.
There's an important element in another recommendation of cooperation, and here we're talking about making clear to the different parts of the government, you know, state, local, federal, and so on, you know, what the elements of the problem are. Breaking down the elements of sharing information, which obviously was a problem in the 9/11 attack, and also international cooperation and sharing of information.
Information is a really important part of all this. And it's an even deeper problem here than what we talked about with 9/11. 9/11 was tactical intelligence. This is happening here, and you want to know about it there. We're talking about sharing really basic things. If you want your police to essentially be eyes and ears when it comes to nuclear terrorism, you want to tell them a little bit about, in general, what they should be looking for. If you want to get border guards to be more effective, you want to get some idea to them of what threats they might have their eyes out for. And we can do some of it. But when it comes to nuclear in particular, our instinct is to keep secret whatever we can. And that is the goal. And we don't ask enough, can we gain from sharing certain information? Now, I don't want to reverse the policy and just let everything out there, but we need a more deliberate process to see what the balance is and where we can benefit from sharing information. Now, there's a really tricky element to this. It's not just about sharing information within government, between federal and state and local, or even internationally. If one of the pieces here is that terrorist groups are often afraid of failure, what you want to do is convince them that they're likely to fail. And to do that, you have to tell them something about what you're up to. Mm-hmm. That's another very challenging piece of secrecy. Sometimes letting the bad guys know a bit more about what you know can be valuable too. Very hard for us to accept, though.
Mm-hmm. Make us aware that in the end all of this might not work. So a piece of this also is to be prepared if, God forbid, there should be a dirty bomb go off and so on, so that our response should be such that it makes the situation less worse than it might be.
Right, and people have accepted that for dirty bombs for quite a long time. They've accepted that the immediate consequences aren't enormous. This is about psychological and social consequences, about long-term contamination. They haven't accepted it when it comes to honest-to-goodness nuclear bombs with mushroom clouds, because the consequences are horrific no matter what you do afterwards. You could be looking quite easily at, let's say, deaths on the order of 100,000 people. So it's been really taboo to talk about measures you might take to lessen the consequences. It makes you seem kind of heartless. There has been a bit more interest recently in talking about this. People have started to grapple with it because, frankly, we really don't want this to happen. But if it did happen and we were not prepared to save another 100,000 lives, we would really have done something wrong. Now, should we shift our efforts in bulk away from stopping things and toward making sure you have only 100,000 people die rather than 200,000 people? Absolutely not. But it's not something that we should neglect. I also put another bit of a twist on this in the book. There are defensive tools and defensive maneuvers and measures you might take that would not necessarily stop a terrorist group from pulling off a plot, but might lead them to do something that has a lower impact. So not just emergency response that can cut the impact. And again, it's really tough to deal with. Someone's going to say, you're accepting a terrorist plot that can kill 5,000 people? No one's accepting it. But if it's possible that one could kill 100,000 people, then steps that would lower those consequences are things you do have to think about seriously, no matter how unpleasant they are.
If the next president of the United States were to be given this book, there's really one point that you would want to get across. If that's possible, tell us what that is.
Don't shoot for the moon. Don't assume that by going for perfection, whatever you're going to get is the best possible thing. Get a realistic assessment of the threat that focuses not just on our vulnerabilities, but on vulnerabilities of the terrorist group. Request that and make sure it goes out throughout government. That can organically stimulate coordination. If everyone at least is working off the same page, the same scouting report on the enemy, they may start to naturally do things that complement each other. I'd want to suggest a bit of a package of things, but that is the one thing that I would emphasize. And tied up in that is the idea that you can't demand perfection.
And you've written a book here that the general public can and should read. What would you like the informed citizen to get out of the book?
I'd like them to get a few things out of it. First, I find that no matter how scary a topic, understanding more about the details makes you feel better, makes you feel calmer. I had an experience where I worked on a documentary for Nova several years ago on dirty bombs. And I got two sets of calls the next morning. Professional colleagues called and said, why the heck are you scaring everyone out there? And friends and family called and said, I feel so much better after having watched that show. Because just getting details and feeling like someone wasn't hiding something from them made them feel safer. So I want people to have a feel that they understand things. I'd also like them to understand that demanding perfection is dangerous. And a lot of what happens in our counterterrorism and homeland security efforts when it comes to nuclear terrorism is driven by the public and by Congress. Every time someone can put out a press release saying this piece of the defense was tested and it only worked 1 in 4 times, the public is aghast and they either demand an overreaction of trying to make it perfect or the opposite direction of saying, why are we even bothering with this? I'd like people to see that you have to always put these things in context. If I string together 10 of those 1 in 4 chances of failure, the group ends up with a 5% chance of success. That's a very, very different picture. And I'd like people to understand that these things need to be put in context to understand them properly.
Michael, I want to show your book one more time on nuclear terrorism. And I want to thank you for being on our show and for helping us understand the problem and understand that it's not going to go away, but we really have to think about it. Thank you.
It's my pleasure to be speaking with you.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.